You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Hello, friends. Yes, just another warm welcome on behalf of all of the Iona community team and the Wild Goose Expedition 2026. One of the delightful things in my kind of role as coordinating everything that happens here is every year I get to meet new, intriguing people. And who more intriguing than you, Matt? It's been delightful to have what email exchange we've had so far and to get a bit of a sense of what you are bringing to us today. And it was definitely your theme that grabbed me, this sense of rage against the machine. And what do we do with our rage? So it looks like I wasn't the only person that was intrigued. I guess we're all come with that sense of curiosity and maybe just looking for some helpful hints and some things to grapple with in this whole big issue that we find in life. So really look forward to what you're going to have to share with us. Over to Matt.
Thank you so much, Jay. Thank you. All right. Well, hello, Greenbelt. Greenbelters have good t-shirts, don't they? There's been some good t-shirts, funny slogans. My favourite that I've seen so far is a picture of what I think was a raccoon wearing a cowboy hat, and it said, "Actually, this is my first rodeo." And it appealed to me because this is my first rodeo here. So I'm really super grateful for Wild Goose for hosting and all of you for showing up, especially as in our family, we had to decide between this and the Big Red Balloon Show. So it was a hard one. Anyway, this is Rage Against the Machine, or, well, first of all, let me clarify. I think this isn't the band Rage Against the Machine, sorry to disappoint, nor is it a cover band. And actually, the title should probably be Rage Against the Machine. There was supposed to be a question mark on the end of my title. It went missing somewhere. And so if you came here ready to rage and you're disappointed by the question mark, then feel free to leave. That's fine. The question is this. In an age of polarization, deepening disunity, which we are noticing. I'm not the only person, obviously, to be speaking about this. Does our rage do anything to disrupt the machine? Or are there instances where it becomes fuel for the very machine that we rage against? That's the question. Is there another way? Is there something else we can do? And the caveat that I want to begin with is that, I don't know. Of course I don't know. Like, well, I do have some thoughts. I do have some thoughts, which I'd love to share with you. I have some stories. I have a little bit of experience. And I've come to some conclusions. I've read some stuff. But, you know, I don't know. This is me figuring this out. And I bet there is a wealth of knowledge and experience in this room. And I would love to hear some of that. Hopefully we'll have time to get into some of that later. But I'd love to begin by telling you a Matrix story. You seen The Matrix? You know about The Matrix? Anyone not seen The Matrix? Few of you. Warning, spoilers coming. But you know, it's 27 years old. Can it be any louder? I can be. Anyway, The Matrix came out in 1999, directed by the Wachowski sisters. And if you haven't seen it, are we there? There we are. Does that work? Anyone's ears splitting? No, fine. Okay.
You need to shout.
Well, I'm going to in a minute. You just hold, and then the stage dive, and you are right there for it. The Matrix is an allegory about life in the late 20th century, and it reveals the world as a simulation. Everything that we can see, touch, smell, hear, whatever all the other senses, all of that is a simulation which has been created by a machine in order to capture and pacify the human race, in order to hold us captive, whilst humans are literally made into resources for this machine. The machine runs from the life of these humans. And so our protagonist, Neo, his job in this movie is to wake up. to wake up to who he is, and take on his villainous opposition, the drably besuited bureaucratic agent Smith. And so he has to wake up and wake up all of humanity with him. Oh, and there's loads of kung fu and it's brilliant and you should definitely watch it if you haven't seen it. I remember watching it for the first time. I think I was 13 years old, thereabouts. My sister was 15. My parents were going out for the evening. And we were at an age where I suppose you could trust us pretty reliably to not injure ourselves. The same could not be said for injuring one another. And so the parenting move, smart parenting move of my mum, was rent a video. So Blockbuster video calls. Back we come with the Matrix in hand. And I remember throughout the film having my mind blown over and over again, turning to my sister wide-eyed. What is this? What is this? And then, you know, here's the big spoiler. Neo does it in the end. He defeats the machines. I won't say much more than that. But he, in the epilogue, I want to tell you about the epilogue because that's what really grabbed me. In the epilogue, he's won already. It's post the end of the movie and he steps into a phone box and he picks up a phone and he speaks to the machine. Let me read you what he says. He says, "I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to show you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to say. See, I'm going to show them a world without you, a world without rules and controls, without borders and boundaries, a world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you." And then he hangs up the phone. Rage Against the Machine starts playing. It's a song called Wake Up. Do you know the song? Do you want to sing it with me? This is what happens, and he steps out onto this busy metropolitan street in this like floor-length black trench coat, and he stands on the corner and it drops to this absolute banger of a bass line, which I won't do for you right now, and he slowly, he looks side to side, he puts on his shades, and then he looks up to the sky. And then the camera pans back and up and up and up and shows the city from above, at which point we get Zach De La Rocha and we get Tom Morello's screeching guitar, and Zach De La Rocha goes, "Come on!" And he flies up into the sky. He shows them what it looks like to be free of the rules of the machine. And there am I, 13 years old, mouth fully agog, watching these credits roll, listening to the lyrics of this song, Wake Up, the lyrics, with a fist in the air in the land of hypocrisy. Instantly radicalized. It awakened something in me. It gave permission for something latent within me. And I spent the next 10, maybe more, years of my life raging against any machine I could find. Anything whatsoever. Supermarket policy. Rage! Societal expectations. No. Mr. Jenkins? Mm-mm. He was my head of year. Which is why it was a big surprise to me and many who knew me that a decade or so later, I found myself exploring ordination in the C of E, in the Church of England. Did someone boo? But you get the point, right? The institutional religious machine of the country, if there is one. My bishop sitting right here in the middle of the room. I'll be careful what I say. But I suppose this move to join the C of E, to be ordained as a priest within the Church of England, came from three things. One, a belief that the church has something vital to offer to our spiritually starved nation. The church has got something precious and potent and alive if we can only wake up to it. Wake up to it ourselves. Belief. Number two, a conviction that you can only change things from within. You don't make lasting change from the outside throwing stones. You have to be able to appeal to the authority structures from which something sees itself in order to spark change. That was the conviction that I was operating on. Belief, conviction, and finally ignorance. I just had no idea what I was getting into. No idea. And I really did have no clue. And I was trained and I got into it. And then I started to figure out what this whole thing was about. I thought that this was a one day a week gig. You know, I thought I'm free Sundays. I could know. And I learned lots and lots of things. But one of the things that surprised me the most, was that there are these worlds within the C of E, the world of the parish, which is your priests and your chaplains and the church on the ground, people like yourselves, if you find yourself in a church, taking part in this movement to try and do something, to try and be something in the world. And then there's the world of the diocese, which is made up of bishops and archdeacons and panels and advisors and all of this stuff that I didn't know about. I didn't know anything about this particularly. And what was startling to me, I remember calling my archdeacon very early on into my ministry and saying, nobody trusts you. Nobody trusts you. There's a real palpable distrust here. Quite a well-documented and palpable distrust between these two worlds. And it wasn't long after I was ordained and in the role, I was off in part of London, and I came face to face with some of this some of what had sparked some of the distrust. I'd say in the part of the world that I was, the diocese did some wonderful things, and also sometimes operated as kind of a nameless, faceless, unknowable, at worst seemingly unaccountable entity, which would hand down direction from above. So there's this sense that there's this thing and it's dictating, but it doesn't. There's this gap between the world that it's dictating to and the world that it's in, and that's where a lot of the distrust was coming from. And I came face to face with this a little while after being in ministry, when I was visited by my very own Agent Smith, who came and what they promised was growth and flourishing for the parish. Growth and flourishing from the parish. But I found out quite quickly that this was a plan on paper that would provide growth and flourishing. From where I stood, actually what it was going to do was ride roughshod over rooted community, over history, freedom of people, beauty, faith, long-standing faith. It was going to ride roughshod over people, which, by the way, here's a bit of systems theory for you. Some of the hallmarks of what the machine looks like. As I was reading, thinking about this subject in order to talk to you today, I came across the work of a chap, very interesting American chap called Lewis Mumford. He was a historian, sociologist, and a techno-philosopher. Put that on your business card. He was alive 1895 through to 1990, which means he witnessed the Second Industrial Revolution. He witnessed kind of steel, electricity, railways, cars, telecoms, microwave ovens, and washing machines. And he was worried about what technology was doing to people. If he could see us now, hey? But his point wasn't Luddite in nature. He didn't say, oh, we need to get rid of all technology. What he said was, this technology we're building supports a way of living, a societal order that we have been developing for millennia. And so when he says, his book's called The Myth of the Machine, when he says machine, he's not talking about a machine, a piece of technology. He's not talking about chatbots or light bulbs or any of that. He's talking about large-scale systems of human organization where people are coordinated as though they were interchangeable mechanical parts. They are cogs in a machine. And the archetype that he appeals to is that of ancient Egypt. He talks about the pyramids. And he says, essentially, he says, you don't build pyramids with clever tools. That's not how the Egyptians build pyramids, not with clever tools. You build them with hierarchy, bureaucracy, discipline, surveillance, coercion. This is how you build pyramids. This is how you build an empire. You build them with humans who become cogs towards a grand end. To put it in another way, you build them through slavery. You build them through humans who are dehumanized. These are the hallmarks of the machine. To Mumford, the machine isn't a thing out there. It's a way of seeing and thinking and organizing that dehumanizes in the pursuit of a goal. And there was I in my parish in London, and I was hearing, it doesn't really matter if this cog's got feelings, because the new cog is going to get shit done. And it didn't seem right to me. You know, maybe I'm just a lowly priest who doesn't understand these things, but I have seen the Prince of Egypt. And I got the gist. I got the gist that the God of this story, of this particular story, is a God who loves and liberates all. A God who sets people free from the grasp of the machine. This is the foundational story of the sacred scripture to which I have spent my life trying to pursue. It is a rejection of dehumanization right at the heart of it. And so I did what any self-respecting priest would. I donned my sandals, I took up my staff, and I said, "Let my people go." It was actually, it was way less fun than that. What happened was the parish rallied, and that was beautiful. These people of this parish organized and they pushed back, but it was slow and it was painful and it was disorienting, and it was you know, in when I look at what happened to me in my life, it was hurting, it's damaging. I bear some of the scars still, but in the end we did avoid the plans. It cost me my chance to remain there long term, but this parish stood up for its soul. We took on Agent Smith. We raged and we won. But something about it bothered me. Something about all of the way that this happened bothered me. And it's best summed up by a lady called Joan. Joan was one of the older members of the community. She loved the community dearly. And she felt it slipping away, and that hurt her. She was established within the community, and she felt utterly powerless to do anything about what was happening, and that hurt her. And so she started to get these feelings of rage towards this diocese that were welling up inside of her. And I was trying my hardest, probably failing sometimes, to be very responsible in the way that I communicated with my parish, to say, look, this is what's developing, trying to give the benefit of the doubt wherever I could. But Joan, she wasn't buying that. Like, literally at the mention of the word diocese, she da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And on one occasion, our bishop came to visit us, and Joan started booing. Joan couldn't hear as well as she thought she could. So these boos were loud. She refused to shake hands with our bishop. Here's the thing about that. Joan booing away, the people of the parish behind me saying, "Yeah, thanks, Matt, you're leading us, you're organizing us, thank you. That feels really good. Feels really good for a room full of people to go, yeah, you're right." And I go, "Yeah, I'm right." That feels good. And in the end, our arguments won the day. We were right, right? But the question that was with me and settled with me was, who really wins? Who really wins? If we've turned a human being, a bishop in this occasion, into a pantomime villain in pursuit of our own goal, who really wins? I told you, I came into the C of E with a conviction that change occurs from within, but here was I, effectively being within, but being without, saying, yeah, I'm part of the C of E, but I'm not like those guys. I'm one of the cool priests. Yes, alluring, isn't it? the technical sociological term is coughing. Do you know that? Cutting off reflected failure. I'm not with those guys. I'm not with those guys. It's got nothing to do with me. It strikes me that in the world of politics that we live in right now, something like this seems to be playing out. We live in a time, I don't know if you've noticed, of norm violation. That's what it's been called by political scientists, where political figures do increasingly outrageous things. Have you noticed that happening? Some Nazi salutes and all of this stuff. It's all under that category. It sparks outrage. It sparks outrage. And if you are like me in this room, you might have felt outraged by some of these things. And too right? You know, this flagrant moral decay happening in our midst. Sound the alarm. Tell somebody. Surely that's the right thing. Don't just stand there. Do something. And so much of the, you know, the beautiful ethos of this Greenbelt Festival is that, you know, this faith and activism hand in hand in hand. But with it comes a cyclical consequence in the world of politics also right now, because outrage provokes counter outrage. You have two parties outraged that each other are outraged with each other, that they couldn't possibly see that I'm also a human, by the way. And so I'm outraged that you're outraged, that I'm outraged that you're outraged and you're stupid. That's how it plays out. And it turns out that all of that outrage is identity forming. Our identities are formed by that. And stronger identities turn into partisan loyalty, which in turn, if we're not careful, brings us to a place of less willingness to condemn our own side, which makes room for more norm violation. More outrageous things can happen. And people go, oh, no, I'm not going to criticize that because this is my party and my team and I'm in. It turns out that there are forms of outrage that resist evil, and there are forms of outrage that can become part of the mechanism by which evil reproduces itself. Did you see the interview with Elon Musk and The Economist? Did anyone put themselves through that? No? Wow, not a big economist crowd in this room. Wow, well, you are missing out, because here's some outrage. It's a totally outrageous interview, and I bring it just as an example of this kind of some of this norm violation. He's interviewed by the editor-in-chief of The Economist, Zanny Minton-Beddoes, and she's asking him about that tweet that he said saying, civil war is inevitable in the UK, and she says, do you not think that that's dangerous? Don't you think you have some responsibility to not do that? And he says, well, it is inevitable, isn't it? At which point it just descends into utter farce, because she says to him, well, when were you last here in the UK? And he says, a couple of years ago. And she goes, well, I live here, so I know better. And literally at one point, Elon Musk says, I've been there literally 100 times. And then he offers to take Zanny on a walking tour of the UK, of Britain, to show her how vile we've all become here. And she says, yeah, okay, let's go on a walking tour. Like, I can't believe this is politics at a global level playing out in front of my eyes. I suspect they'll be passing through here anytime now on the walking tour. But in the comments, you see this playing out. There are as many defenders as there are accusers, and as many accusers as there are defenders. Both sides riled up. Don't spend your time in the YouTube's comments, I think is the moral of that story. But, you know, the pantomime boos roll in. It's easy to get riled to this place, and it leads to, you can see it brewing, this separation, this segregation, this dehumanization. Whether it's on a global stage or whether it's in a parish or wherever else you might find it, it's my observation, my conviction that wherever we choose this, we choose the way of the machine. We choose the way of the machine. We exchange our common humanity for our ambition, whatever that might be. We exchange our common humanity for our ambition. I've been out of London for a couple of years now, in the beautiful land of Bath, with a wonderful bishop. but Joan and her story has stuck with me. Joan and her story has stuck with me. All the enmity, all the distance, all the egoic puffing up of having stopped the machine, having won, having raged and won. And this question remains with me and has been with me. You know, did I play it right? Did I play this right? Or did I just short circuit a path to growth, to transformation, to true real life? Did I achieve a goal but stop us from getting somewhere that we truly deserve to, that we truly need to be? For myself, for Joan, for the people of the parish, when I think back to all of that resentment, it doesn't feel like the promise of life that Jesus promised. It doesn't feel like life in all of its fullness. Do you know, talking of life in all of its fullness, on a Saturday morning, I go for a run. Can you tell? I go for a run, and then I have a terrible habit of running just way faster than I should be, and so I'm a sweaty, horrible mess, and I go to my local Tesco's, and before I walk in, I try and mop it up with my t-shirt, but it's not working. I'm a red, hot, sweaty mess, and I buy avocados, I buy sourdough bread, because I'm a millennial, and I go home, and I cook breakfast for my wife. That feels like life, though, doesn't it? Doesn't that feel like living? That feels alive. Or, you know, sometimes I take an old copy of the Church Times and I douse that thing in vinegar and I clean my windows. That feels like living. I play basketball with my kids on the driveway for hours. Sometimes I find myself beside someone who is dying. And I think, I have no idea what to do. And so I think, what would my friend Chloe do? And I take hold of their hand and I pray with them. That feels like living. All of these things feel like living. Recently, 6 weeks ago now, the end of term, I've got little kids, and they had an end of term concert thing where they took the books that they've been reading and they performed them as songs. It's a bit weird, but it was great. And my five-year-old, Levi, yeah, you, in their class, they've been reading a book called The Color Monster. Anyone read it? Yes, come on. It's about this monster, or maybe a series of monsters. That wasn't so clear in the song. But they, you know, its emotions are all tangled up. It's in a big mess, and it needs some help to untangle its emotions so it can be free and have some fun. And that was the song they sang. Happiness Shines, or Yellow Like the Sun. We want to share this feeling with everyone. or Red is Anger makes you stomp, stomp, stomp with a roar and a shout and a what's it all about? The kids love that one the most. And in this song, they're dealing with these emotions. They're helping the color monster to organize his interior life so he might be a free and healthy monster. I don't know. And we're there. We're listening to them singing this song and all the other parents are clapping along. Yeah, we love this song. And I was weeping. I was weeping. Two reasons, really. Deep joy that my five-year-old and all of his mates know that it's okay to be angry, that it's okay to be sad, it's okay to be scared, that you can organize these feelings within you, that it's okay that they all belong. And weeping from a sense of grief that I didn't know this when I was 5 years old, and that the five-year-old that lives inside of me, my inner child, didn't eat a child, my inner child can't hear that. No matter how much I shout, my inner child cannot hear that message. I'm still policing myself. I'm still dehumanizing myself because sometimes I feel angry, sometimes I feel sad, and sometimes I'm too tired to care. All of that makes me feel alive. And it feels so, so, so very far from refusing to shake hands, from pantomime boos, from YouTube comment wars. Earlier this year, I had another encounter with an Agent Smith. Different context, different situation, but the same hallmarks. In my life, they wielded power that I didn't know that they wielded, and they came and they wielded it clumsily, is what I'd say. They were They were unmoved by the damage that they might cause to the older and less measurable things. They were unmoved by that. They were riding roughshod again. And so, you know, if you know anything about me from these last half an hour or whatever, like this is a red rag to a bull. And so don the sunglasses, the trench coat, the sandals, the staff, all of it together. And how dare they? Indignant. Rage starts to come out and start to gather around other people, using my charisma to gather other people against. Say, how dare they? I know. Can you believe they did this? Come on. Let's form an angry mob. I accidentally do that sometimes. I felt solidarity rising, and it's that feeling of someone saying, do you know, you're right. Yeah, I'm right, aren't I? Let's go. I want to be the right one. How dare they? But then I stopped. Then I stopped because I could see the road ahead. I could see where it ended, and I knew that I didn't want to go there. I was confronted by the wisdom of Jesus. The words that have been passed down to us, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. If you don't know the story, Jesus' opponents are trying to trap him by saying, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? And the history lesson in here is that the taxes paid to Rome uphold the violent system, the brutal imperial system of conquest and domination. And so they're essentially saying, hey, Jesus, should we pay our taxes and support the machine? Should we go on this conquest by paying our taxes, or don't we pay? Because are you an insurrectionist, really, and should we get them to kill you? This is the trap that they're laying up for him. And he holds up a Roman coin and he says to them, whose image do you see on this coin? And they say, well, it's Caesar on there. And he says, give that which is Caesar's to Caesar's and that which is God's to God. He doesn't say, yeah, Rome is right, we should do what they say. But he also refuses to scapegoat them. He refuses to play the game that points at the other and goes, oh, they're not like us, they're the baddie. I'm the goody here, they're the baddie. Because if you know anything about this gospel story of Jesus the Christ, he ultimately gets scapegoated, and that's how he ends up on a cross. He says, I refuse to play that game. And when he refuses to play that game, he issues an invitation to his hearers, to his objectors, to all of Rome. And the invitation is, there is another way of doing this. Which game do you want to play? Which game do you want to play? The Caesar game, or do you want to go the way of God? What do you want to do? We create our world together, is what he's saying. What kind of world do you want to make? I was convicted by this saying of Jesus just bashing around in the back of my head. I was convicted by this, and I felt challenged to lay down my outrage at the situation, lay down my outrage at the injustice that was being done, in pursuit of something greater. Something greater might emerge. I'm really aware, even as I say it, that's easy for me to say. This example is small fry. I am not a refugee. I am not Muslim. I am not Jewish. I do not have dark skin. I am not a member of a sexual minority. I am insulated from much of the hatred that others endure in the world. I recognize that. From my position of privilege and amplification here today, please don't hear me say, just stop being angry. Stop being angry, everyone, huh? that's not what this is. I want to say something far more nuanced and much less new. And I want to appeal to the wisdom of Martin Luther King to do so, who famously said, darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hatred cannot drive out hatred, only love can do that. And this is a man who faced much darkness and much hatred. For more than 12 years, his life was daily threatened. Daily threatened. There was a theologian, James Cone, who's written extensively about Martin Luther King. And he tells the story of a time when King's house was bombed, and he and his family, his children, narrowly escaped the bombing. And of course, an angry crowd gathers around. They come with their guns. They want revenge. They are raging. And King raises his hand. He says, we cannot solve this problem through retaliatory violence. We must meet violence with nonviolence. We must love our white brothers no matter what they do to us. We must make them know that we love them. We must make them know that we love them. And for cross, for King, the cross is the ultimate expression of this love. It is the paradigm through which he could make sense of his own suffering. Nonviolence, not as an act of passive surrender where we go, fine, you just do what you want, but a love that refuses to reproduce violence, that refuses to play that game, and a deep hope that even evil can be redeemed. He said this, I will die standing up for the freedom of my people. And if physical death is the price I must pay to free my white brothers and sisters, then nothing could be more redemptive. Here's a man whose conviction around the cross frees him from the fear of death and gives him courage to pursue justice no matter what the cost. The cross is at the center of his faith. That's how he can love his enemies, because he chases after those words that are recorded for us from the cross. Christ on the cross says, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. There are no more startling, frightening words to me in the world, I think, than that. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. These remembered words invite us into a fullness of life that I'm just not ready for. A fullness of life. They cause us to recognize that human evil is something that we are all trapped by. We are all suffering from, and we are all in our own ways participating in. They force us to remember that the machine is not a person who can be maligned or turned into a monster, but it is a way of organizing ourselves which chooses progress over making space for our messy, chaotic, vulnerable, fallible humanity. And this machine consumes all of us. It consumes us all. Donald's such a clown, isn't he? Yeah. I'm tired of his red hat. I'm tired of his giant ego trashing the world. But sometimes I'm just overwhelmed by grief for the man. Because if our egos are formed by our wounds, I wonder what kind of wound produces an ego that large. Father, forgive him, for surely, surely he doesn't know what he's doing. Forgive us all. Surely none of us really know. I remember one step lower. Promises a redemptive end. One step lower. I remember reading a few years ago Richard Rohr. He was talking about our commitment to meritocracy, which is the system by which we earn our own way. It's a resistance to grace, and therefore the flip side of earning your own way is a resistance also to forgiveness, because if someone else can't earn their own way, toss them to the side. No space for forgiveness there. And he said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. We don't want to apply this to Hitler, do we? We don't want to apply this phrase to Hitler. And understandably, it's not a good look to be the one who's advocating for the forgiveness of Hitler. But I think it's probably also true to say there is a bit of laziness on our part to imagine that all of the horrors of Nazism can be explained by one man, one nation, or even a collection of nations. Hitler seizes a cultural moment, but he didn't create that moment. There's this wonderful quote to that end from the French philosopher Simone Weil, and she wrote this during the war. She's watching the horrors of the war unfold, and she says this, "The only punishment capable of punishing Hitler and deterring little boys thirsting for greatness in coming centuries by following his example is such a total transformation of the meaning attached to greatness that he should thereby be excluded from it." It's interesting because she's not saying we punish by defeating him militarily. She's making a deeper cultural observation and asking us a question. What kind of civilization produces children who can see Hitler as great? And it's a bit of an odd quote because, you know, we're so far removed that we go, well, nobody thinks Hitler's great, do we? No one calls it. He's universally condemned as evil almost. But her argument is this, that if our culture continues to identify greatness with power, domination, conquest, fame, and bending history to your will, then Hitler remains in some sense great. And every time we go, yeah, this power is the great way, we are spurring a society that makes space for that. She pleads with us. She pleads with us. Please don't shuffle the cards. Please don't just put yourself on top. We need a new game altogether. That's how she pleads with us. Hate cannot drive out hate. Instead, let's turn our attention towards reality and truthfulness and self-sacrifice and holiness and beauty. Let's lay down our force rather than exercise it. The machine is not a thing out there that is pulling the strings. It's all of us. We choose where this goes. We make it. We inhabit it. We participate in it. Therefore, we can make something else. We can make something else. Perhaps, in the end, we win the war by laying down our guns. Perhaps in the end we win the war by laying down our guns. At the end of the Matrix, I told you, Neo reveals this new world opening up by defying the laws of the old world. He flies and he shows there can be a new way. I wonder what our epilogue might look like. What might it look like? Neo speaks to the machines and he says, "I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see." I wonder what kind of world might we reveal. What kind of new world? Let's say that the Elon and Zenny, they do come on their trip. And they're arriving into your hometown. They're going to be walking through. But they don't find us booing, hissing, burning Teslas. It's not an incitement to violence. They don't find us quarreling or deepening division. He actually doesn't find us paying him any attention at all. Perhaps we can render unto Elon that which is Elon's. And instead, he finds us planting carrots with our hands in the soil, cooking lasagna, crying with joy as your five-year-old sings to you, stroking our pets and knitting for our nephews and nieces. Let him find us taking out our neighbor's bins, reading to our children, painting pictures and fixing broken things. Let him find us sitting in silence, walking at sunrise, talking until dawn and savoring all that is good. In our age of polarization and deepening disunity, if we want to disrupt the machine, maybe it's time for a new game. Maybe it's time for a new game. Perhaps we have forgotten in some sense who we are, what we are for. Maybe we've started to believe that the human being can be optimized. That our foibles, our disagreements, that our diversions, that our division can be paved over, that it can be overcome. Perhaps they've forgotten that we are all mixed up messes of all of these things. We are all the colour monster, and we all need to be able to organise, own, name, and accept all of it to embrace the fullness of our humanity. I think the Wachowski sisters were right. It's time for us to wake up. And perhaps the real act of resistance is not becoming better at fighting the machine, but a wholesale rejection of its premise that our messy, complex, vulnerable human journeys can be or even should be streamlined. Perhaps the real act of resistance is choosing the fullness of your humanity, whatever that looks like and wherever you are, and choosing it with the fullness of the love of God that liberates all who come. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.